Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. As Kimberly was kind enough to say, I'm Stacey Abrams. I'm the House Minority Leader for the Georgia General Assembly and State Representative from the 89th House District, in case you find yourself in Georgia. But I'm here today in San Francisco because I want to serve as your moderator for the program. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it is my pleasure and my privilege to introduce today's speaker and special guest, Steve Phillips, civil rights attorney, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, New York Times best-selling author of the book we're here to talk about today, Brown is the New White. You should clap for that. I say that because it has been my privilege to know Steve actually for 5 years. I met Steve right after I became the minority leader, and I had the audacity to get on a plane to go and meet this man that I'd heard about for many years. I asked him for a meeting. I walked into his office. He didn't know me. He had no reason to talk to me. I had a couple of friends call ahead and say that I wasn't a stalker, and he was kind enough to listen to me explain to him how I thought Georgia, the state of Georgia, the crimson state of Georgia, could turn blue. And unlike a number of people with whom I had that conversation, he did not laugh. He did not scoff. He did not walk out of his office. He asked me really thoughtful questions. And he did something more important, which was ask me how he could help. And that's why I think that Steve Phillips is a visionary on this topic. He is someone who 5 years ago understood the demographic changes that were coming to this country. And instead of hearkening back to the old way of thinking about things, he decided that he was not only going to identify the changes, but he was going to make sure that he could be the clarion who told America about what was coming. And it is my pleasure, therefore, to introduce Mr. Steve Phillips. So, Steve, I want to start with a softball question. How do we make sure Donald Trump doesn't become president?
We all vote. Next question. No, I think it's actually it's fascinating to watch the misanalysis and misunderstanding of what's actually going on, and that people are extrapolating out his success in the Republican primary to the country as a whole, which is not to say we should take him lightly at all. It's been fascinating also to watch the media begin to legitimize him, right? I mean, people forget that right after he announced and he came out with the whole anti-Mexican comment, that he was like a pariah, racist pariah, Macy's, all these other people cutting their ties from him. It's like that's all forgotten now. And so that's going to continue, actually. The media is going to continue to legitimize him, lift him up, give him credibility. But what people don't realize is that, well, for one, I'm amused by how many Republicans are, like, genuinely perplexed around what actually happened. And look at all these, you know, people who are, like, you know, xenophobic and responding to these messages. And I'm like, who did they think was voting for them all these years, right? And so there has been clearly 30 to 35% of the Republican base is uncomfortable at best and hostile at worst to the demographic changes in this country. And they have never had a champion like Trump, a billionaire, a celebrity, somebody who brings credibility to those views and that viewpoint. So they came out in droves because they hadn't ever had anybody champion their views. But it's clearly a minority of the country. And so that's what gets left out of this analysis. You can't just extrapolate his success in the Republican Party, which is only, you know, half less than half of the country, and then only half of that to the entire electorate. But the way to beat him is that we have to turn out and vote. And then even these polls that you're seeing, and then some of these polls in states that show it, the race being closer, like they're Ohio, Pennsylvania, and I think it was Florida, had to, like, were neck and neck. But in all of the models of those polls, the electorate is whiter than it was in 2012. So if people of color do not come out and vote in large numbers, then Trump can be competitive. But if we do vote, and the progressives and Democrats do what we need to do to turn out a large, enthusiastic voting population of people of color, then we not only will we win, but we have the opportunity. We should win. We should take back the Senate. There are 7 seats held by Republicans in states that Obama won, and we have a chance to really deal a fundamental blow to not just to the Republican Party, but to the type of politics which is rooted in racial resentment and fear. And so that's what the possibility is. But to make it to get there, we have to turn out our vote and turn it out in large numbers.
So how do you turn out voters of color?
Well, you communicate with them. You don't take them for granted. And you try to work to inspire and mobilize them. So this is the challenge. And really, frankly, this was really what led me to write the book. Because first I was like, I thought everybody knew all this stuff, right? That, you know, we had Obama, you know, ran twice, inspiring candidate of color on top of the ticket, mobilized large numbers of people of color, and he won, and then won again, which was even more significant as reelection, 5 million fewer voters, 5 million fewer white voters, and still got reelected. And so that was clear to me that that was the path to win, but it's not been internalized in the progressive movement and the Democratic Party. They continue to chase the shrinking sector of the electorate, which is the white swing voter. And so people of color are not going to vote if you don't talk to them, if you don't hire people from their communities to communicate with them, to organize them, to bring them out to vote, and to be able to mobilize to participate. But when that is done, people can actually turn out. So Obama got 200,000 more black votes in Ohio in 2012 than he did in 2008. They did that by having 700 full-time staff people on the ground. They're there a year ahead of time, working with churches, working with faith-based organizations, partnering with them on voter drives, building those types of relationships, having that presence in the community, and being able to turn those people out. But if we're just going to run 30-second television ads targeting moderate white Republicans to tell them how bad Trump is, that's not going to get people of color out to vote. And that's the strategic challenge that we have in this election.
Most of the pundits who are acknowledging the demographic changes, their caveat is that they would acknowledge everything that you articulate about the numbers, but they will say that the only reason Obama received those votes in 2008 and 2012 is because he was African American. Is it true that a white candidate at the top of the Democratic ticket can yield the same level of voters of color that Obama achieved?
Essentially, the answer is yes, if, again, you organize and speak to. So people of color did not just come out to vote for Obama just because he was black. And Obama was, he represented and spoke to and embodied the struggles of people of color who have been historically marginalized and excluded from the community. And so he was able to both speak that language substantively and symbolically, right? The whole yes, we can, right? Right after he says yes, we can in that first speech, he says it's words that were whispered by slaves and abolitionists. And so talking the language that really the people who have been struggling for justice and equality. People struggling for justice and equality don't just want a black president. We're happy to have a black president. But we also want to have economic equality. We want to have good schools. We want to have good housing, which I think is the vision for the country as a whole. And so those are the things that have to be lifted up and be able to put forward in terms of what is at stake in this election, to move us closer towards economic equality, to have good schools for everybody, to complete the push for universal health care, to have a safer and healthier planet and neighborhoods. That agenda can and will speak to people if it's put forward in a compelling and convincing fashion.
Well, staying on the topic, you spend a great deal of time and I think very thoughtful analysis of the policy issues that progressive leaders have to espouse, that campaigns have to talk about. But you lay out several policy options that the funders of these campaigns, if these policies are to be enacted, they would be the ones paying for it. You're asking billionaires to pay heavier taxes. You're asking people who've benefited from the very system that you decry to dismantle that system. Why would they?
Well, I will say two things. One is one of the fascinating parts about this election is that it was particularly fascinating that it's come after the Citizens United decision, which just unleashed big money into our political system. But the biggest beneficiary of that this election was Jeb Bush, who went around and raised $100 million, I still think illegally the way he did it, but get $100 million from major donors and then got crushed by a guy sitting at home on Twitter. Right. And so you have that reality. And then on the Democratic side, there has never been a progressive political force with this kind of funding power as what Bernie Sanders has unleashed within the country in $27 a person contribution. So first of all, I'm not convinced that it is necessarily just going to be about the wealthy donors in terms of them being the ones that have to be won over to that. I do think there's something different. Most Democratic major donors don't give money for economic self-interest. If they would be Republicans. And I mean, that's how kind of that I think there is, in fact, something more altruistic, something more idealistic within those within the people from that standpoint. And so I think if we could speak to that to convince them around we could have a better society if they actually pay more and pay their fair share. And it's interesting being able to do take the time in the book to do the research. So one of the things that was most illuminating to me was what is possible by moving from a discussion around income inequality to wealth inequality. In that the top 1% in the country, people making who have $13 million in assets, collectively have $26 trillion in assets. So that if we could actually institute a wealth tax, not just on income, but tax that wealth at 2%, that's $500 billion a year. Think tanks have calculated what it would take to lift everybody out of poverty, and it's about $270 billion. So we could end poverty just by asking the top 1% and nobody else to pay 2% of that wealth tax, and the historic return on the stock market since 28 is 10%. So we're not even saying that we're going to make them poorer, just saying get richer a little slower, and we could actually end poverty. And I do think that that's the kind of thing that people could respond to in terms of the public policy debate.
Do you think that Hillary Clinton gets that message?
I emailed some of her people that section of my book. I don't think either. I mean, I don't know. Not at the moment. And then I think, I even think that to the extent that Bernie talks about inequality, that it's mainly income inequality. And so I think that hoping that we can push him to lift up the issue around wealth inequality more. So we're not there yet, but I do think that we're further along on a progressive spectrum around talking about inequality than we have been historically. And I think that there are, and actually the reason, I'm not kidding, I did email some of Hillary's people that I know. The reason I did is because she actually did give us, I thought it was a very good speech about addressing racial inequality in the problems. And she was talking about a $125 billion plan and program to be able to address racial inequalities in our society, which I think is the right problem to be focusing in on. So I was trying to point them to wealth inequality as a potential solution to fund that type of a program.
Staying on that lines, and I'm taking a few of the questions from the audience. That first question regarding Secretary Clinton was from the audience, and another one is how effective has President Obama been in achieving the racial equity goals that you've described?
That's a good question. It's a complicated question. And so, for one, I don't think we should minimize, and I don't think we have sufficiently appreciated, and we may not be able to appreciate for a decade or so, the cultural, sociological, psychological impact of having this president and this first family in the White House for 8 years. What it means for all of the children within this country who have grown up to see this man and this first family in the White House is incalculable. And so that's a very significant piece of the social change piece. It doesn't get credited enough. Another thing that doesn't get credited enough is he put the first Latina on the Supreme Court, right? And so that's never been, so the other things he's done which have been significant that have not been appreciated, right? So I think that there's that. I do wish they had gone faster, harder when they first went in. in 2009. I think there, I feel there was too much effort to try to, you know, work across the aisle and win over Republicans and try to be able to be reasonable with people who were not reasonable. And we could have done more. We could have moved healthcare quicker. We could have passed immigration reform if we had gone more aggressively in 2009. So that, I think, is the primary disappointment. But I think since his reelection, he's actually been much more aggressive and bold in trying to move in these different directions. Even, you know, the recent thing, like in the past couple of days, around overtime pay. I mean, they're doing a lot of things now that are moving us more rapidly in the direction of equality. So I think that that's all to the good.
Well, you founded the first super PAC to support President Obama's 2008 election, and you've been instrumental in supporting groups across the country who have been in bits and pieces and not necessarily always with the same mindset, been trying to live out the ethos of Brown is the New White. Can you talk a little bit about those programs that you've been the most impressed by? You spoke about what President Obama has accomplished in recent years, but talk a little bit about how both the work that you've been doing and certainly his leadership, how that has influenced those community groups and those states that are starting to really organize and galvanize these communities of color.
Well, one of those states is Georgia. Right? So people don't appreciate that Obama lost Georgia in 2008 by 250,000 votes without contesting it. And it's a state that has 900,000 eligible non-voting people of color. And it's not, you know, this is genuine sincere. I mean, Stacey organized and ran the New Georgia Project. It's registered tens of thousands of African-American voters in 2014. Which had not been done before. And so that whole framework, which is really, I mean, I came into politics with the Rainbow Coalition. Jesse Jackson used to talk about David versus Goliath, but there are all these rocks lying around. And he referenced that the rocks lying around were the eligible non-voting people of color. Texas has 4 million eligible non-voting people of color, in a state where Democrats lose by 600,000 to 900,000 votes. So groups like Texas Organizing Project do a lot of the underground work. And they did the underground work to turn out the vote in Houston that actually elected the African-American mayor of Houston. So that's an example of that type of work. You know, I've been happy to support and try to get off the ground an effort called Inclusive, which is a talent bank for people of color to be able to place them in different campaigns. So the people keep saying, well, we can't find anybody. We're like, well, they're right here, right? And so these are some of the things we've been trying to actually identify and move forward. But sadly, it's not sufficiently invested in and not a high enough priority yet for the overall progressive movement. But the talent is there. The leadership is there. We just need more investment in those right leaders doing that kind of work.
Well, you talk about Ambassador Andy Young's very famous comment about smart-ass white boys. I always like being able to say that. Talk to me about the programs that you see those organizations and those groups trying to implement that are well-intentioned but wrong-headed.
So for the record, if I say fewer smart-ass white boys, and footnote 5 of chapter 5 of my book does say that some of my best friends are white guys. So I just want to be on the record about that. But, I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing it right now in this election that the strategies and the plans that are being implemented in terms of how to defeat Trump are primarily designed to be able to focus in on and change the minds of and influence moderate to conservative whites. And so there, and what's one of the things that's fascinating that people do not at all appreciate in terms of this political analysis is that there just are not that many swing voters left. And that there was a significant study that looked at the voting survey data for the past 60 years. And the swing voters are at an all-time low. And it's 5% of the entire electorate, which is about 6 million people from the 2012 election. There are 7.6 million newly eligible people of color since 2012. There are 26 million eligible non-voting people of color in 2012. So where are you going to focus your time, energy, and resources? And this is actually back to your earlier point about kind of non-person of color, track voters of color. 79% of people of color have voted Democratic since 1976 on average. So yes, people of color will vote in that direction. So where do you put your time, energy, and resources? But most of the people running Democratic and progressive politics right now are white, almost exclusively. I mean, in a party that is 46% people of color, if not more, 46% of Obama's voters are people of color, and yet almost all the people controlling the large institutions, the large organizations, and the large budgets in this election are white. And so I have taken to referring to it as a near-apartheid situation we have in the progressive movement. And so the plans that have been laid, even publicly disclosed, around from the independent side and the different programs people are going to be doing and the different super PACs, the budgets add up to around $200 million. The vast majority of that are negative ads about how Trump is a bad guy, which is just, again, designed to change the minds of the white swing voters, where that money could be put into communities, hiring staff people, organizing people of color to make sure we turn out in large numbers. So the mindset, and this is exactly what Andy Young was talking about, that he was trying to tell Mondale's people the benefit of his experience, having worked with Dr. King, having done voter mobilization, had got elected to Congress himself through a voter mobilization of African-American programs, that's where the priority and the resources should go. But they were, you know, smart-ass consultants who were like, no, we're going to run these TV ads. And that's what they did, and then they lost. 30 years later, we're still running these TV ads.
I'm going to take a few questions that are all Trump-related. I was intending not to talk about him anymore after the beginning, but we all get pulled into his wake. So one conversation that's continued to happen about Donald Trump is that there is this quiet group of Trump supporters that we're not aware of. Trump likes to trumpet his ability to bring in new voters, new Democrats, new independents, although there was a very interesting Politico analysis yesterday that showed that he actually has not done any of those things, that really the core of his base has been Republican voters who simply don't vote in primaries very often. So he did animate voters, but these are not voters who necessarily change the electorate. However, the question from the audience is, do you feel that Trump has a reverse Bradley effect, where voters aren't telling pollsters that they're voting for him but will?
That's a good question. I do think the election is going to be closer than people appreciate, but I think partly it's because a combination of things we've already talked about. One is that I think that the media is going to legitimize him and whitewash his past behavior. And so they're going to make him seem legitimate, and they're not. And I was thinking, while I was watching this, you know, earlier today, I was like, how far do you have to go before the media will actually consistently call you the racist that you are, right? And so would they have legitimized George Wallace? And it's like, what is the direction? But it's happening, and it's going to happen. So that's going to make him more acceptable, I think, in the eyes of Republicans, who will then come home. So you have that. I do think that he will bring out some level of new voters. One of the things I didn't know until I was actually researching this just recently is that Perot brought out a lot of new voters in 92. There were 13 million more people voted in 92 than voted in 88. So there are some of these disaffected folks in the middle who have been sitting out, who may come out, which just gets back to the fundamental imperative around getting our people out. Right? I mean, my fundamental premise in the book, which is not just academic, it's been proved now, well, it's been proved four times over the past 8 years, positively by Obama's wins and negatively in the 2010 and 2014 when people of color did not come out. There are more of us than there are of them. And so if we bring our people out, progressive people of color and progressive whites are the majority of people in the country and the majority of eligible voters in this country. And if we come out to be the actual voters, then we will defeat him.
A corollary to that is, do you think that racism is greater today as evidenced by Donald Trump's support, or does his candidacy simply make it more visible? And contrast that, if you will, I'm adding on to this question, with what President Obama has experienced and what that means in the context of the work that needs to be done.
I don't know if I would say it was greater that, somebody asked me at one of the, when it's a book event we did in Denver, and I said, this is one of those hopeful, optimistic books that I've read in a long time. And first I said, well, please put that on Amazon. After that, I was saying, well, if you look at it in the sweep of history, right, Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party had to storm the floor to get seated, to have an integrated delegation at the 1964 Democratic Convention. 1984, 1988, Jesse Jackson had 3.5 million votes, 400 delegates in 84, 1,200 delegates, 7 million votes in 1988, the highest runner-up to that point in time. And then we have elected and reelected an African-American president. So that is not inconsequential in terms of the flow and the sweep of this country, right? If you want to go all the way back, right? But Jesse Jackson has this phrase when you talk to him about how, like, hard things are right now and people complain. He says, well, it beats picking cotton, right? And so in terms of the flow and the sweep of where we're at. But I do believe that the intensity of this moment is tied to an inchoate feeling that a lot of these people feel, which I think is correct, that this is their last best chance to hold back the changes within the country, and that the demographic trend is so profound, and it's happening so rapidly, frankly. My first chapter is 51% and growing every day. Every single day between births, deaths, and legal immigration, 1,000 whites are added to the population, and 7,000 people of color added to the population. So the intensity of this moment is that they feel like this is their chance to hold it back. And that if they can't and they don't, then I think that it's going to be irreversible. And this notion about being able to win by appealing to white nativism and racial resentment is not even going to be a logical or desired strategy the way it has been for the past 40 years.
In your book, you do a very, I think, eloquent job of framing out why this matters. And you harken back to your parents' experience of buying their first house. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and then link that to why you do what you do today?
The story is that my parents moved to Cleveland Heights, Ohio in 1964. And it was an all-white neighborhood. My brother wound up being the first black student in that elementary school. And they could not buy their home. The seller would not sell it to them because they were black. And so we had to get a white lawyer, Byron Krantz, to buy the house, deed it over to them. I only actually recently learned a lot of the details of this. Actually, I learned election night 2012. My dad was in town telling us more about the details of that. And a neighbor across the street, who was not happy about it, said, called a meeting around with the other neighbors to say, what are we going to do about Byron Krantz? Are we going to string him up? And so this neighbor was very upset, called it, and that in some kind of cosmic balancing, my brothers and I became best friends with his kids, actually, when we were growing up, actually. But I think that they were always, it was the milieu of the civil rights movement, right? So my parents took me to see Martin Luther King when I was 3 years old when he came to Cleveland. There were all these biographies in Life magazine, Look magazine, about the civil rights movement around the house. So, and that's even come to the discussion and the talk with my mom and whatnot. So that was always part of the milieu. And which led me to, I read all the biographies of Martin Luther King in my elementary school library. So I think that, and then, my grandfather was a minister. And so I think between these two different things of the religious tradition, the social justice tradition, that those have been deeply embedded within me. And so I think that really is the work that I've been trying to do in my life, is to really be able to carry on that struggle, be able to advance that type of effort to make society more just. And I think I'm quite literally a child of the civil rights movement. And that has shaped my viewpoint, my outlook, my sense of both what's possible and well as what's necessary to do.
Bernie Sanders has taken a great deal of flack about his dismissal of Southern states in the primary process. But his analysis echoes the spending decisions of most campaigns. Can you talk a bit about, let's say that you tomorrow become the czar of campaign finance and campaign funding for Democrats. We have anointed you, and you have a $1 billion budget. How do you divide up the money? Give me categories and specifics.
So the Democrats in 2012 spent $2.7 billion at the federal
level. You only get a billion.
So, all right, well, I tried. So at a fundamental level, you need to look at where do your votes come from. And then your budget needs to reflect that. So 46% of the Democratic votes are people of color. It may be more. The electorate was 29% eligible voters, people of color, in 2012. It's going to be 31% this year. So it could be even closer to half of the voters. And then you have to allocate between mobilization of your supporters, and that, again, 80% of people of color tend to vote Democratic, and then persuasion of those who you may need to persuade, if you need to persuade anybody. And then it's not cheap, so you have to invest in actually organizing. And then the reality of the country, because there's so much history of inequality and racial inequality, that people of color's lives are more difficult. And so that's the barriers to get out to vote, to participate in the electoral process, are larger. And that happens when you have fewer resources. So, I don't know, two-thirds, one-third, two-thirds staffing, mobilization, people in the community. I mean, I was at a national faith gathering a couple months ago, and I was thinking, why isn't there a civic engagement coordinator for every black church in the country to make sure that every person in that church is registered to vote, that they know when the election is, that they're actually supported to actually get out to the polls? So fundamentally, and I would even go further, I'll go 80-20, that if the premise is correct, that there's only 5% swing voters, period, and that the key to victory is turning our people out to vote, then I would put most of the money into an integrated plan around, which is largely staff-driven, of having human beings on the ground in the neighborhoods, in the communities, and knocking on doors, doing calls, identifying people, getting them out to vote, reinforced with some media around letting people know when the election is, clarifying the issues, making sure people realize that what the stakes are and what the potential is of the election. And then I would do some targeting that swing vote population, but I wouldn't go more than 20-25%.
Can you talk a little bit about other minority groups? So there's a great deal of conversation about the role that African Americans play in the Democratic Party. There's been increasing attention to the role of Latinos. There's been much less attention to the Asian American voting participation in the Democratic side of politics. Talk a little bit about the role that minorities across the board, and then those specific groups, what role they play in winning this election.
So on the one hand, historically, everybody thinks about minorities as African Americans, and so it's much more diverse now than it has been. But now the danger is that people are going to forget about African Americans, and so more in terms of Obama's voters, more of Obama's voters were African American than were white men. And so when you think about how the money is being spent and who we're actually going after this election, that's like a profound reality. So that's a core piece. And then of the 79% who vote Democratic, African Americans have been voted at the highest levels and most consistently the highest levels, frequently over 90%, even not for Obama. So that's that. But Africans are not the largest grouping of color within the country now. It's Latinos. And so that is the next largest population, which is complicated in terms of the composition of it. I think that's something that people don't fully appreciate either, and it's something that we wrestled with in the book around how do you both communicate and honor the history of each grouping and communicate it, and have one book. And so there's like you could actually have 14 different groups, right? If you look at Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans. I think we were Guatemalans at one point. And so it turns out like how do you really? And so we finally realized that's like a whole other book. But in terms of Latino population, which is largely Mexican American, which is something that's not necessarily fully appreciated as well. So that's an important piece to understand the historical dimensions of that, right? I mean, much of the Southwest of this country used to be Mexico. What's that? Somebody putting on a Facebook, they have these hats saying, "Make America Mexico again," right? And so that I thought that was interesting. So, but then to understand the other Latino groups where they're at geographically are significant. So obviously Latinos are, Cubans are significant in Florida, but the Cuban population has changed. A lot of younger Cubans, and even those who are older, actually have a lot more, at least Garcia Bedoya goes into a lot of this in her book, Latino Politics, more of a tradition around labor and understanding relating to labor. And so there are aspects of the complexity of that community. Then you have a lot of Puerto Ricans moving to Central Florida now. So that brings Florida's dynamics into play in terms of this election. So you have that whole reality. Then you have in terms of Asian Americans, and probably the single most surprising statistic to me, which opened up a whole door around U.S. history when I was researching the book, is that 74% of Asian American adults are foreign born. And I had to like reread that, but then it takes you back to 1965, to the Immigration and Naturalization Act, which actually takes you back to 1790, which was the first Immigration and Naturalization Act, which said to be a U.S. citizen, you had to be a free white person. And that was good law explicitly in this country until 1952, and in practice until 1965. So it's really only since 1965 that Asians have been able to come to this country to actually become citizens. And Asians are the fastest growing population within the country, actually, currently. And we're seeing it particularly in California. In terms of California politics, there are more Asian Americans than there are African Americans. They're going to play an increasingly critical role. I think John Cheng declared today or yesterday for governor for 2018, and have been voting increasingly progressive over the past 20 years or so. So, and I think play strategic roles in particular places. I think, but you have to understand the cultural realities and nuances and hopes and dreams of each of those communities in each of those areas to be able to effectively bring them into the fold. But if you can, then you can put together this coalition which can win in all these different places.
Fantastic. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio Program, and our guest today is Steve Phillips, civil rights attorney, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and New York Times best-selling author of Brown is the New White. We are discussing the current and future impact of changing demographics on American politics. I'm Stacey Abrams, House Minority Leader and State Representative in the Georgia General Assembly, and your moderator for today's program. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel. So you've allocated $1 billion. Where does the ground staff come from? Where do you find these people? Is it the DNC? Is it the candidate? Is it somewhere else? How do you actually staff this program?
So linked to that is I would take 2% and put it into a permanent year-to-year fund that helps to identify, recruit, and train activists and organizers across the country. So there are a lot of I remember when I was at Stanford back in the day, one of the black staff people said that says every African American staff person on this campus is underemployed, and that has always stuck with me. For all these different years. So there's lots of talent. Which reminds me of the Louis Gossett Jr. at this quote back in the 80s, says that there's plenty of good roles for black actors. They're just being taken by white actors, right? And so there is a lot of talent that's actually out there that people who are working on campaigns, who have been part of campaigns, who have been actually part of the mix, but they're not validated and elevated and like blessed or laid hands on as like the brilliant people or the people who actually should be, you know, looked to or and invested in. So there needs to be an inventory of who is within the different campaigns, who has done this work. And that's a larger pool of people than people appreciate, but they're not respected or seen in that way. And so there are very few people of color who are given the chance to run a statewide campaign. And it gets to be a cyclical situation. And so you haven't run a statewide campaign, so you can't run a statewide campaign. But how do you actually break into that cycle? No one's born running statewide campaigns, right? So at some point, somebody has to get given a chance. But Cory Booker looked to Adiso Dumisi, who had not run a statewide campaign, but was a talented political operative, and says, come run my U.S. Senate campaign, which he did, and Cory won, and that puts Adiso in that category now. There are a lot of Adisos out there. And so the work has to be done to identify, attract, recruit, and put those people in leadership positions. And then, so Hillary, to her credit, in Nevada, took Emmy Ruiz, who's a young Latina, and made her in charge of Nevada. Not the Latinos in Nevada, the whole state. And she won that state. So there's a lot of people like that who need to be identified, elevated, and put in charge of positions. And then you find the people who want to work on campaigns. A lot of people want to volunteer, they want to be involved, and they need to be trained and organized to be able to do that. And so that's some of the work that you've been doing. Maybe you should talk a little bit about that, because it's something I've tried to, you know, be helpful to, is your whole, you know, Blue Institute work and grooming some people.
So the Blue Institute is a program that we launched in 2015 to exactly answer that issue, that if you look at campaigns across the South and Southwest, especially in 2014, over and over again, when people were asked, do you have staff of color, the answer was, well, there's no one who can do that work. And when they did hire them, they were almost exclusively hired in field, which, you know, for all of the reasons, especially as a black woman from the South, being told that someone's being put in the field just sometimes rubs you the wrong way. But the reality was that there were very few who had the experience level to be trusted by those who were in charge of campaigns with the complexity of running a statewide race, of running a congressional race. And so with Steve's early investment and our ability to raise money from some other groups, we brought in 44 people of color, half Latino, half African American, from the 16 southern and southwestern states. And we trained them over the course of a week and a half. They took training to become campaign managers, data directors, communication directors, to understand finance. And then what we were most impressed by and were most excited by, impressed is the wrong word, we were most excited by the fact that we were able to work with Inclusive, the group that Steve referenced earlier. They came down and did resume training, and we actually got organizations from across the country to come and do a job fair that week. And of the 44, 10 of them were hired by the end of the week, and we now have a 78% placement rate of all of our young people. And so some are working with the Bernie campaign, some are with Hillary, some are in congressional races, and now we have become one of the data banks. We get requests, do you have any Blue Institute graduates that you can send to us? And that's been because of the work that you were willing to finance and the willingness to early on acknowledge the need to get this work done.
And how much did that program cost?
$152,000.
And they're publicly committed $170 million in progressive and Democratic spending, the majority of which is going towards negative TV ads.
So, and just to put a fine point on it, it took us almost 6 months to raise that $152,000. We cannot raise the money right now. We have not been able to raise the money to replicate the program from the very people who have hired from within that program. Because I think to the point of brown is the new white, while they find those who benefited from the program appreciate the training, they don't necessarily know that it's necessary, because which candidates would they go and work for next? And so it becomes that cyclical problem of, if you don't have the experience, you can't have the job, but you can't have the job if you don't have the experience. But it's also an assumption that you should only work if you're working for a candidate of color. And that leads to my next question. There's a conversation about how to engage African American, Latino, Asian Americans, how to engage people of color on the operative side. Talk about the candidate side and what all of those groups, the DSCC, the DCCC, the DNC, the DLCC, the DGA, need to be doing in terms of candidate recruitment.
You're trying to get me in trouble, aren't you? Right. So, I mean, the clearest, most recent, most painful examples, which has happened in Maryland. So the Maryland U.S. Senate race. In the history of the United States of America, there has been one African-American woman in the U.S. Senate, just one, Carol Moseley Braun in 1992. Barbara Mikulski decided to step down in Maryland. Donna Edwards, African-American congresswoman, you know, community activist, extremely progressive person, stepped forward to run. Also, Chris Van Hollen, a white congressman, he wanted to run. So Harry Reid, like within hours, came out for Van Hollen, the very top Democrat in the U.S. Senate, put his weight and force in the path of this African-American woman. And then much of the Democratic Party establishment put its full force behind Van Hollen. Those are not the things you want to do if you want to lift up a person of color. And so this is the type of it was rare because it was so clear of a case study around how the institutional forces came behind and replicated the racial inequalities that we've actually had within the country. So work needs to be done to identify promising candidates, get behind them early, rally and marshal resources behind them, connect them up to networks of people around the country so that they get known more. They can actually be able to raise money more nationally in that regard. And then to do for them what has been traditionally done for the long string of white men who've been in these different positions. And so that is not what has been happening, and certainly not what has been happening at the level and the extent to which it needs to happen, right? So then in the Maryland race, the Democratic Senate campaign committee was like, well, it's a primary. We can't get involved in the middle of a primary. And they got involved in Pennsylvania in a primary. They're getting involved in Florida in a primary. So when they want to, they can insert themselves. So somebody has to lift this up as a priority and shine a light on it and really force people to be able to actually put their money where their mouth is. Because right now, that's not what's happening. And we will have a significant opportunity in that regard over the next couple of months, which is a piece I just wrote past couple of days around the vice presidential pick. We've never had a vice president of color in the history of this country. That's not a calculation of talent. And clearly, Dan Quayle put that to rest, right? So it's just an issue of what you think the electorate will tolerate. And if you truly believe that there is an electorate which will get behind a candidate of color at the top of the ticket, or on the ticket, as we've seen in the past 8 years, why wouldn't you choose one of the talented people of color to be on the vice presidential ticket?
So because you handled that very controversial question so effectively, I'm now going to ask you to talk about organized labor. What role do you see for organized labor in this election to get out the vote among people of color? And as a part of that, talk about the structure of organized labor, both as a financer of, but also as a component of the challenges that you're talking about.
Yeah, so I mean, labor has both the potential and the challenges that the rest of the progressive movement. One of the things that's least appreciated from a political social change standpoint is that organized labor has probably the best funding model in terms of being able to move resources in the progressive space. And there they have millions of people who pay money every single month that gets pooled to be able to put into the political sphere. So it's a powerful force in terms of what it can do and what it has the ability to do. Labor suffers from the same challenges around the having its leadership reflect both its membership as well as the country overall, right? The overwhelming majority of labor leaders in the country are still white and still don't necessarily reflect the composition of the country. And so then that gets to this challenge around how and where do they focus their time, energy, and efforts. And I do think, frankly, that there is still too much focus, particularly from an electoral standpoint, around how do you change the minds and the viewpoints of conservative white working class people. And I think we confuse trying to win them over in a short-term electoral campaign with limited time, energy, and resources with what the policies of the country should be. And so that, and look at healthcare as a perfect example of that. So rather than spend all of our time and energy trying to change the minds of those people and spend massive amounts of millions of dollars showing them how they're voting against their interests, et cetera, let's go with those who want to vote with us, win the election, and then provide health care to everybody, including those who didn't even want to have it. Right. So
this conversation has been fairly centered on candidates, although I think your 2% fund really talked about how do you create a sustainable long-term infrastructure. But let's talk about what the average progressive can do right now to help make sure that brown is the new white becomes part of the narrative, not just as a candidate issue, but as a structural change to how we operate.
Well, I mean, I do say, you know, the dedication of the book, all those working to make your organizations more reflective of the new American majority and effective at fighting for justice and equality, this book is for you. And so everybody, these challenges are so historic and so pervasive and so widespread, they play themselves out everywhere. And so we need every organization, whether it's the place you work or the place you volunteer or your local Democratic Party, to be lifting up these issues and demanding more both transparency and accountability around what we're actually, how we're structured and who gets promoted, who gets hired, who gets funded, who gets prioritized. That takes place throughout the society in lots of different ways. And that we have a more democratized or flattened work chart in our society, I guess. And so social media makes a lot of things possible in terms of being able to hold people accountable. And so getting the word out around who's doing well and who's not doing well within the whole social media space. I try to provide a set of questions in chapter 6 of the book in terms of campaigns around the Invest Wisely piece to actually, for all stakeholders. And so if you've given any money, if you give them $10 to a campaign, you're a stakeholder, you can ask them, do you have a plan? Are you going, how many, what's your win number of votes that you need to win? How many of those come from people of color? Does your budget match that plan? Those are the kinds of questions and transparency and accountability which does not play itself out very often within political campaigns. And I think everybody can play a role in pushing that kind of a change within our democracy writ large.
One of the questions that I think is sort of embedded in what you talk about is what role do people of color have in owning their role in the electorate? What aren't we doing, which allows this larger superstructure to keep us in place? I mean, 46%, the Tea Party found a very effective way to make their voices heard, even though they are the minority of the Republican Party. What's the responsibility of people of color?
Right. Yeah, now that's, I've been increasingly coming to this as I've been thinking about and, you know, doing this book tour and talking to different people, is that I think this is the same people say, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? And I keep saying, well, what would you do if you knew you had a majority? And so both in terms of being bolder around our public policies and the things that we want to actually see society do, and we often shortchange our agenda because we fear it'll alienate people or it's not going to be able to get majority support. So we should be lifting up a much more bold, aggressive public policy vision within this country around ending poverty. Sorry, so there's a lot of tinkering around the edges that could happen, but we should talk about ending poverty, health care for everybody. College should be free. Bernie is exactly right on that. And so that should be put forward as an agenda. But I also think it does then come to us as individuals, both in terms of how we carry ourselves. So we've been, I remember what I was saying after the Obama election, people started to talk about people of color, et cetera. And I was like, after you've been ignored for 30 or 40 years, being listened to is disorienting, right? And so, but we're so used to being on the outside and having to protest and get the people in power to change and et cetera. But we can be the people in power. And so that's, I think one of the main messages I'm trying to leave to people is that to start to think of ourselves that way, to really go from protest to power. And we saw some of that in the district attorney races in Chicago and in Cleveland, where we went from protesting in the streets, these district attorneys who would not hold these police officers accountable for shooting these unarmed young black people, to then going to the polls and voting them out of office. So we have that potential and that ability, and I think the other piece that then comes with that also is the responsibility to prepare ourselves to lead. And so if we really thought we were going to be leading cities and counties and states and the country, what would we be doing in terms of being educating ourselves and also just elevating our game of the level of discipline and rigor and functioning and effectiveness that we all have in a day-to-day fashion, right? I mean, I mentioned something in the book about how, I'm sure that, Harriet Tubman was bringing people on the Underground Railroad up from the South. Some people wanted to sleep in, right? They didn't want to get up, didn't want to walk that long each day, right? But you got to do what you got to do to be able to get towards freedom. I mean, our opportunity is significantly large at this point in time.
Well, speaking to that, I mean, you do, I think, a very excellent job of really delineating the demographic shifts, and you talked about it a bit here. But the fastest growing population right now is millennials, and those millennials are more and more often people of color, but they're also the least likely to vote. And so you take two groups, young people and people of color, who are the two least likely to vote groups, and you put them together. How do we activate them? What's the paradigm shift that has to occur to engage them? And what's the generational responsibility that we have to engage them?
I think part of it, I do think this is one of the lessons of this election, and I think it is probably perhaps the one of the greatest contribution or lasting contributions of what the Sanders campaign is going to be, is he has expanded the imagination around what's possible, and to be able to put out as far-reaching and radical an agenda that he has put forward in terms of a vision of society, and to see it be received with such electoral enthusiasm should be eye-opening to all of us. And so clearly there's something there around appealing to young people by inspiring them with a very courageous, bold, visionary set of politics. And so it's one thing, if we're talking again around tinkering around the edges, et cetera, but it's another thing to say to young people that college should be free. And we are going to advance that and move that forward. And if we can't get it through Congress, let's try it at the different states, and which they actually could be put forward. College used to be free in CUNY and in community colleges in California. So it's not like there's some crazy idea that's never been put forward before. So, but those kinds of approaches towards taking a vision of our society, how it could be so much better and so much more just and equal, and presenting that in the context of the election is the type of thing which I think we're clearly seeing people resonate with and makes it much more immediate and tangible and relevant to participate in our process.
So Democrats are often accused of taking African-American voters for granted, and we have also given lip service to Latinos and not necessarily put the money behind that. What is it that Democrats are going to do wrong that will yield, or what will Republicans do right that will shift minority support from Democrats to Republicans?
Well, it's going to be, what's fascinating about this election is that in many ways, the 2020 election has already begun. So it's not like Rubio went home to go home, or Cruz went home to go home. I mean, they're anticipating that Trump will lose, and they're positioning themselves for 2020. And I have been most concerned from as a Democrat about Rubio for a long time, because he is able to articulate the immigrant experience in ways that touches people and can actually attract the support of people of color. And if you look at the autopsy that the Republicans did after the 2012 election, it's 100-plus pages. It's very detailed. It's very specific. Go to immigration and naturalization ceremonies and be present there. Elevate staff of color. By contrast, the Democrats put out a 7-page report 10 months late that the Washington Post referred to as political pablum, right? And so the Republicans were actually on course to be able to make inroads into the communities of color. And that was the plan, right? Bush is married to a Mexican woman, there's, you know, mixed race kids. Rubio has been this mix. Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, they were lifting up a rainbow of people trying to make the, and that was the plan until Trump had a different plan, right? And so in some ways, we're somewhat ironically, I don't want to say lucky, but he has disrupted that, but only delayed it. And so they're going to come back. And the other reality, the Republicans having a 40-year history of building their majorities on, or building their electoral plan on racial resentment, is that the Democrats have never had to compete for people of color's vote. They never had to say why they are actually better. They just say, those guys want to get rid of you entirely. So there's going to be a need to put forward an agenda, a track record, a commitment in order to be able to be more effective. And that really, I think, is going to be the struggle and the debate. It's really pretty much immediately after this election, 17, 18, 19, what that struggle is going to look like.
We've got 4 minutes left, so I'm going to be nice. What's the question I haven't asked you that you wanted me to ask?
Well, I wanted you to help me make the argument to what will likely be the Clinton campaign around why Georgia should be contested this year.
Because we are a blue state. Georgia, so to put this in context, Georgia in 2016 is 53% white, 32% African American, 10% Latino, and 5% Asian American. 23% of the white vote is consistently Democratic. The false narrative has been that you have to wait until a Georgia or any other Deep South state actually flips and becomes majority-minority. That's not true. My very aggressive shorthand for it is that we have spent a great deal of money trying to turn atheists into Catholics, so convince swing voters in Georgia that they are Democrats. So we're trying to convince these white moderate Republicans to vote Democratic, so turning atheists into Catholics. I think we just need to get Baptists to go to church. We have the voters. We have voters of color, and there are two groups. Steve alluded to it earlier. In 2008, President Obama lost Georgia by 205,000 votes without spending a dollar. In 2012, he lost by 305,000 votes, and that was when everyone in the South was angry. We, in 2014, had a very competitive Senate and governor's race, and the margin of loss where Republicans wiped out the South, we lost by less than 200,000 votes. At the same time, we have almost a million people of color who are unregistered and eligible to vote. Georgia does not disenfranchise ex-felons. But more than that, we have 600,000 low-propensity voters, so voters who voted either in 08 or in 12, but not in 10 or 14. And no one has reached out to them to convince them to vote. You only need 200,000, maybe 300,000 of them to win. We did a program in 2014 to test out this theory, because it is a theory. with at the cost of $9.80 per vote, we turned out 197,000 low propensity voters. The average turnout rate among that group was 36.3%. We were able to boost it to 71% simply because we talked to them. And Steve was instrumental in getting that done. He was instrumental in helping raise the funds for that. And if you look at page 100, he mentions it. The point being that with a modest investment, we were able to demonstrate proof of concept. Had we been able to double that investment, we would have won that Senate race. Had we tripled it, we would have won the Senate race and that governor's race, and Georgia would be a blue state today. We are exactly what Brown is the New White is telling you. It is a combination of progressive whites, Latino, African-American, Asian-Americans who, when given the ability to vote for the candidate of their choice and knowing about the election, they will vote the right way every single time, and we win.
And that really is why I wanted Stacey to be part of this conversation, is that quite literally I feel the work that she's doing is a manifestation of the concepts that we're actually talking about, and that Georgia as a state represents the potential of what the country, the direction that it should be moving in. And that these are the areas that are going to be leading the future of the country. I mean, Arizona should be coming into play this year as well. So that's another place in that regard. But also, I think, frankly, in terms of I am part of the mission, I think, is we have to identify and validate and shine a spotlight on the people who will be the leaders of this new American majority. And I really do believe that Stacey and people like Stacey represent the future of the country in terms of the kinds of leadership coming out of these communities and having a vision and the strategy and the commitment to make America better. So thank you for being part of this.
Well, I want to give my thanks and our thanks to Steve Phillips, civil rights attorney, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, the New York Times bestselling author of Brown is the New White. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio and television and on the internet. This program has been part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also wish to remind everyone here that Steve Phillips' new book, Brown is the New White, is for sale, and he'll be signing copies after the program. My name is Stacey Abrams, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.